First of all, I'd like to thank everyone for coming to participate in this conversation. Seated at the front table, desk, whatever it is, are three professors, too. My far left is Professor Mary Leary, whose face you might not recognize because she is a visiting professor at Catholic right now. Right? And she's the author of an article that the Virginia Journal of Social Policy and the Law is publishing this year. And we thought it was such an interesting topic, such an interesting issue that we really wanted to have her come down and talk about it and just engage in a conversation about her ideas. To her right is Professor Stephen Smith. For those of you who may not know Professor Smith, he is a professor here and teaches criminal law in its various iterations. I have moved to federal criminal law this semester. And to my immediate left, Professor Smith's immediate right, is Professor Ann Coughlin, who is also a professor here at the university. And I'm actually taking her this semester as well for two classes. But it is indeed my honor as the editor-in-chief of the journal to welcome them and to welcome all of you. Basically, the format for today's session, Professor Leary is going to share or have some comments for about 20 minutes or so to kind of, for those who have not had the opportunity to read the article, just to lay out her ideas. And Professor Smith will then give a response to her presentation. And following Professor Smith, there will be Professor Coughlin, who will give some comments. And we're just going to have kind of a conversation about it. And at the end, hopefully, if there are any questions or comments from you all, we will invite your input as well. Would you join me in welcoming the three of them?
Thank you, Ray. Good evening, and thank you all for coming, risking this beautiful day to come into a windowless room. So we appreciate that, I think. I want to thank the journal for inviting me down, and of course I want to thank Professor Smith and Coughlin for taking the time to read the article and share their thoughts on what I think is a very complicated problem. And I think this is a problem that touches on criminal law, juvenile law, social policy, and technology as it interfaces with the law. And the problem that I'm speaking about specifically is the problem of juveniles or teens without coercion or grooming from an adult who take pictures of themselves and others and distribute them to others. Okay? This is referred to in my article as self-exploitation. There's no sort of perfect definition for it, but that's the term that I've labeled it. And you really just have to look at the newspaper in the last few months to see what a big issue this is. Just last month in Allentown, Pennsylvania, there was a problem in a high school where some students took pictures of themselves and with their cell phones. In a matter of days, an entire class, meaning an entire grade, had those materials. Therefore, of course, free to be on the internet, never to be returned or retrieved again. In December, I believe it was in Georgia, there was a teen charged in a similar action of distributing photographs of classmates. In December as well, a Florida court upheld the conviction of two juveniles who engaged in similar types of behaviors. Okay, this problem is one that I would submit judges, legislators, prosecutors are just really starting to grapple with. But in their grappling with it, one problem that I observed in looking at the issue is it's being handled on an ad hoc basis. Sometimes prosecuted, sometimes not, etc. And to be frank, the reality is how it's being handled relates directly to if USA Today is at the front door of the DA's office or not. And I think that that is a problem. And so my article seeks to address the very narrow question of what is the appropriate societal response to this activity? Specifically, whether or not we should view this act. Well, let me back up a little bit. Specifically, the problem is one that is not only a social problem, but it is a legal problem. Because the reality is, whenever a juvenile engages in this activity, creates the images of them engaged in sexually explicit conduct and distributes them, they have now produced child pornography and they have now distributed it. Okay, so it now becomes a legal problem. Okay, the kinds of conduct that we see are not just the examples I gave you. We've seen it in commercial production. With the best example of that would be Justin Barry, which is a case with which I'm sure some of you are familiar, and Professor Coughlin, I think, is going to share some thoughts on. He ended up with a commercial website making, I believe it was, well, he had people paying $50 a month to be members of his website, and he made several thousands of dollars. I think estimates have been around $100,000 for this kind of activity. There's another for-profit iteration of this called the cam boy or cam girl phenomenon, where juveniles set up a wish list of things that they would like purchased for them, and in exchange for those items being purchased through a PayPal account, they engage in certain activity vis-a-vis the internet. There's situations like some that I mentioned where juveniles take these images and expect them to be going to a limited audience, a peer or someone with whom they share a romantic relationship. There's as well a phenomenon of youth wanting to record their sexual acts with another. Or we've seen posting on web pages, and probably the best example of that is Jane Brady's reference in the Mississippi Journal of Criminal Law with respect to that. Okay, as I indicated, it is a social problem and it is a legal problem. And the narrow question I'm seeking to address is, what's the prosecutor to do? Okay, on the one hand, and I would submit that we've got sort of a clash, if you will, of models. On the one hand, we have taken in the United States a very aggressive stance with regard to child pornography, a stance which I would submit is not misplaced. We understand on a pretty sophisticated level the social harms that are caused by child pornography, that they go beyond that of the child in the images. And consequently, we have pretty severe criminal penalties. On the other side of the coin, of course, we have our juvenile court model, where we recognize that often destructive behaviors by a minor can be the result of someone perhaps not fully mature enough to appreciate the social harm of the activity that they're causing. And so this paper tries to deal with that specific question of the prosecutor and what are they to do. Should that concept of juvenile prosecution remain on the table? Or should, as some suggest, it be taken off because it's not appropriate? And essentially, in answering that question, I answer the question, it should remain on the table. But like all good lawyers, I have caveats, of course, right? Like in class, every professor has an exception. Well, I suggest to you that it should remain on the table, but here are my caveats. First, it's not a mandatory prosecution. I'm not suggesting that juveniles be prosecuted in every circumstance. What I am suggesting, however, is that jurisdictions develop a protocol of factors to consider to help them assess, as the cases come in, is this something that should be prosecuted or not? What I want us to do is get away from an ad hoc system and to a more systemic approach to what I submit is only going to be an exploding problem. You know, as I like to say, when it involves technology, today's problem is tomorrow's epidemic, and I certainly think the media is reflecting that. The basis for the factors that I propose come from both social science research, primarily Max Taylor and Ethel Quayle, who I would submit are some of the leading researchers in this area, as well as United States Attorney's Manual, the Sentencing Guidelines, and then the National Exploitation Coordination Center in Canada, which has developed a protocol for assessing the severity of images. And the factors that I suggest a prosecutor look to fall into two categories. The first are what I call youth-specific. Looking at the cause behind the exploitation, the amenability for treatment of the juvenile, the support network, the age, the frequency of exploitation. And then I suggest that they also consider factors, what I call crime-specific factors, okay? Specifically looking at the circumstances around the exploitation, whether or not other youths are brought into the production, the role of this particular youth in the production, whether it was for commercial purposes or profit motive, the extent of the distribution, the theme of the images, and the severity of the images. And what I would suggest is if we use a protocol like that or encourage our prosecutors to have a protocol like that, then we're having a systemic approach to this issue, which isn't based on whether or not the DA is going to end up in the newspaper, et cetera, and is based more on properly identifying which cases could benefit from juvenile adjudication. A couple of asides before I get into the support for my thesis. The first is what this paper is not. It's not a call for mandatory prosecution. Second thing this paper is not intended to be is an answer to child pornography. This is a highly complex problem with many aspects to it that can only be solved in an interdisciplinary way. But rather, it is trying to address just that narrow question of, as I say, what's the prosecutor to do? So it is also not an answer to self-exploitation. I'm not submitting that this problem, which I see as exploding, is one that can be handled by the criminal justice system alone. The question I'm simply trying to address is whether or not there's an appropriate role for the criminal justice system in that. Second point I want to make is you hear me use the term juvenile prosecution. Many of you who have taken juvenile law, children law, will say, that's not right, it's supposed to be adjudication, and you're quite right. But for purposes of simplicity and not getting bogged down into, am I trying to pretend adjudication is not prosecution, I'm just referring to it as juvenile prosecution for our purposes and discussion here. Okay. Last point I want to make is some of this might have struck a chord with some of you. I said, did she just say, I want to re-victimize the victim? Is that what she just said? And I'm thankful that Ray didn't read my bio, so I didn't get the, she's a former prosecutor, and yeah, she just wants to throw everyone in jail. Isn't that what she's about? And that's not it. I want to emphasize that much of what drives my thesis is two realities. One is the social harm of these images. As to the child in the pictures, as well as the children are not. But second as well, I want to see is the child themselves. And I would submit that as we have seen in other cases where juveniles engage in self-destructive behavior, which is also criminal, sometimes the juvenile justice system is an opportunity, perhaps the only opportunity at times, to intervene in the life of this juvenile, to address the social harm that's caused, and also to sort of address the self-destructive behavior. And I think that it's important for the prosecutor to at least consider that or have the opportunity to consider it before our juvenile engaged in this behavior turns 18 and maybe engaged in the kind of behavior that goes with it, the trading of images, etc., and finds himself or herself looking at a 5-year or 10-year mandatory minimum for behavior that is almost identical. So I propose to spend the next few minutes discussing essentially what basis, if any, I have for my thesis. Okay, first basis I would submit we discuss is the social harm that's caused by this material. And secondly, then, I want to turn briefly to the purpose behind our juvenile justice system. Okay, the social harms caused by child pornography, I would submit to you, are significant. Okay, a minute on quantity, if you will. It used to be, back in the day, child pornography was relatively difficult to get, relatively. It involved risk-taking on behalf of people who were interested in this material. It involved finding a network of people who were had access to the material, who were willing to exchange it, etc., those sorts of things. But as we all know, the Internet changed everything, and certainly in this context, it's no exception. There's the triple A, as we refer to it, of the Internet, the accessibility, the affordability, and the anonymity. And today we live in a world where today there are at least 100,000 child pornography websites right now, today, if you, according to Internet Watch. The number of child pornography images has increased 1,500% since 1988, and there are over 20,000 images posted each week on the Internet of child pornography. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children estimates that about 5.4% of the child pornography that they see is self-produced. The Department of Justice has suggested it's about 14%, and I'll be the first to tell you, we'll never get good hard numbers on this. And we'll never get good hard numbers on this because the only way to know the circumstances around the production is actually to speak to the child in the images, and that doesn't happen often. Okay. While we know these numbers are hard to identify, I think it's safe to say that all the experts in the area think the numbers are low. And they think the numbers are low, and the best example I can give you is the Child Crimes Against Children Research Center in New Hampshire talks about the changes in technology, essentially. And now with cell phones, with webcams, and all of those things which haven't really been accounted for in the studies, we think the numbers are low. And while surely some of the images that we have estimated, that we believe to be self-produced, are not, one thing we do know from the research, and Kimberly Mitchell has identified this, that the greatest risk factor for self-produced child pornography is whether or not the juvenile is with others when the invitation or the idea to produce these images takes place. Okay? As I indicated, these numbers are expected to increase because of the technology, and they're also expected to increase because of the large role juveniles play in child pornography in general. It's been, some studies have estimated that the largest group of people viewing and possessing child pornography are 15 to 17-year-olds. And some articles have even suggested as many as 11 million American children view child pornography each year. Okay. So I would submit that child pornography itself, the numbers are large, okay? But we also have to think about the quality of the images, and I use that term loosely, but the quality of the images with respect to the social harm caused. And I think the social harm that these images cause matters, and it matters because, thinking back to your first year of criminal law class, what is an actus reus, a voluntary act that causes a social harm? And so we have to really think about what's the social harm caused by these images. And I would submit that it is not just the child in the images. And in fact, our social science research, our legislative history, and the Supreme Court have echoed that there are essentially three categories to social harm: children in the images, children outside the images, and society as a whole. Children in the images, It's obvious, is it not? Children and youth are abused through child sexual abuse images or self-created images. The immediate impact is obvious for the what I refer to as the traditionally produced child pornography image, where a child is sexually assaulted to make the image, clearly. But there's been well-documented and understood long-term effects of being in a child pornography image. Those result in feelings of powerlessness, long-term consequences. In the words of the Supreme Court, the victimization of children involved does not end when the pornographer's camera is put away. The pornography's continued existence causes harm, haunting these children for future years. And that's really a unique characteristic of child pornography, which cannot be underestimated. This is what we refer to as a crime in perpetuity. It will go on forever. Every time those images are viewed, that child is re-victimized. Every time, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, all over the world, once these images are out on the internet, they can't be brought back. And this is clearly, when we talk to victims and we study victims, something that is extremely difficult for them to get over. And that is what we refer to as the long-term effect of this. There's a Florida court that talked about the reasonable expectation that the material will ultimately be disseminated is by itself a compelling state interest for preventing the production of this material. Okay? And I would submit that when the teen produces this image themselves, it's not correct to say they're not harmed. Certainly, the immediate harm is less severe than a child who is obviously victimized by an adult to create the image. There's really no question about that. But there are still significant long-term effects. The Supreme Court talks about the participation in child pornography. And I think participation is a critical word, because that covers both voluntary and involuntary participation. And that a minor, at the time that they make this decision, that he or she lacks sort of the understanding of the destructiveness of his or her actions, does not mean that she forfeits a claim to the harms that are likely, and that all the research I've seen suggests will come later. Okay? There's a compelling state interest in protecting children from sexual exploitation. And again, another court in Florida mentions this. It's true whether or not the person exploiting is the juvenile themselves or somebody else. Okay? And I would submit that adjudication in the juvenile court setting enables the government to participate, to mandate counseling if necessary, to seek deterrent goals, etc., if that is necessary. Okay, so there's the harm to the children in the images. There's also the harm to the children outside the images. Social science research is quite clear in this area. The fact of the matter is, more children are abused because these images are out in the marketplace. The ultimate consumer of these images is the sexual predator. may not be intended at the time of production, but that is the ultimate consumer of these images. Sexual offenders use these images to fuel their assaults. They use it for their own sexual gratification. They use it to groom victims for child sexual assault. They use it to validate their own inclinations and their own inclinations and predilections. That is the reality. And I would say the reality has become crystal clear in the last 3 years. There's a study by Dr. Hernandez out of the Butner Federal Prison, which is about to be released, as well as Dr. Cito's study, that makes clear the link between child pornography and sexual offending. And that's true no matter where these images, no matter the circumstances that these images were created. And in fact, one could argue that these particular images are even more damaging, because we know that sexual offenders use these images to desensitize children, and highly favored in by sexual offenders for images are images where the children appear to be enjoying themselves, because that sends a message to their potential child sexual abuse target that this is all right behavior and harmless behavior, etc. But children are harmed even if it's not a circumstance where an offender, a sexual offender, has seen the images and used them to facilitate a crime. We know that 34% of youth are exposed to unwanted sexual material on the Internet. Again, our researchers Taylor and Quayle expressed deep concern that access to millions of child pornographic images, will adversely impact the future sexual and emotional development of children. We know, well, I shouldn't say we know, the studies suggest that exposure to material like this increases youth becoming offenders. And some researchers have opined that that explains when we have a youth becoming an offender, by that I mean a sexual offender, with no prior history of child sexual assault. They opine that. I wouldn't say that we know that for sure. And lastly, there's a social harm to society as a whole. These images add to the marketplace and are available permanently, but what they do is they affirm the sexual objectification of children, okay, reinforcing the sense that children are sexual objects. To quote from the Child Pornography Prevention Act, the sexualization and erotization of minors encourages societal perceptions of children as sexual objects, leading to further sexual abuse and exploitation and creating an unwholesome environment. This is material that, regardless of how it's been produced, we as a society have said through our criminal laws, through many of our statutory structures, that this, we do not condone this. And the main reason we do not condone this is because of the sexual objectification of children. So I would submit, when we look to all the social harms that these images cause, many of which are still caused regardless of the circumstance around their production, that would support an idea that we leave prosecution possibly on the table. We leave it on the table for possible use, I should say, in a self-produced scenario. I want to turn quickly. I think I've got about 5 more minutes if I'm watching my time correctly. Mr. McKenzie's a very big guy, so I don't want to get him angry. So, right? Okay, he's in charge. When we look at the purpose of our juvenile justice system, okay, and the underpinning and the doctrinal underpinnings, obviously the juvenile justice system is designed to rehabilitate. Okay, the juvenile court's main objective is to inquire into bad behavior and its causes, seek remedies, and adjust the child, rather than merely accuse, convict, and punish. Okay, juvenile court is tasked with doing what is in the child's best interest, and I would submit that although not ideal, it is indeed better for the government to be intervening in a child's life when they're engaged in this kind of activity in a rehabilitative setting, rather than, as I said, the child turning 18 and the government has to intervene and it is not a rehabilitative setting at all. Well, I would agree, and some of you may be thinking, well, wait a minute, if you turn 18 and you create images like this, that's no longer producing child pornography, and you're quite right. But what we see is that this kind of behavior goes hand in hand with the training of images and that sort of thing. And no matter how self-destructive the behavior can be, the government can't do anything when somebody is 18 if they're just producing their own images. But they can do things when they are minors. But more importantly, like I say, I fear for, and I have seen as a prosecutor, the person who turns 18 didn't see, no one ever told him there's anything wrong with doing this before, at least certainly no legal consequences, and finds himself or herself facing a mandatory minimum. The first doctrinal underpinning of juvenile court I want to address briefly is parens patriae. Okay, the idea that it is not only the responsibility of the government, but its duty to intervene in cases where those responsible for the juvenile has failed to protect them. Okay, There's some good language with regard to this. The state may legitimately protect children from self-destructive decisions reflecting the youthful poor judgment that makes them in the eyes of the law beneath the age of consent. Okay? And when a child is in such a state of self-destruction, by using the factors that I suggest, if we have a situation where a child is non-responsive to voluntary or civil intervention into their life, the criminal justice system, or specifically I should say the juvenile justice system, might be an opportunity where, although it is forced on them, might be an opportunity to force them to get the help that they need. Secondly, however, there are police powers at play, I would suggest. This, well, I don't think we can call it a public health problem. That is certainly a problem to the general welfare, the problem to all the other children who will be victimized because of these images, to the children who will be sexually objectified because of these images. And we as a society have labeled them entirely toxic images. Okay? So I would suggest that given that, the police powers would further support leaving prosecution on the table. And one of you may ask, and I think it would be an excellent question, well, why not just a civil child protection proceeding? Why criminal? That seems, or why juvenile adjudication? That seems a little bit heavy-handed. And that, there's a philosophical answer and a practical answer. Philosophically, what is a delinquent act? It is an act that, if engaged in by an adult, would be criminal. So as a philosophical matter, we've identified the production of child pornography as something that is criminal, that produces a social harm, and it's inconsistent to not consider that in the juvenile context the same way. In fact, we as a society condemn this material so much so it's not even worthy of First Amendment protection. It is so damaging to children both within and without the images that you cannot even possess it, unlike obscene speech, which of course you can possess if not trade. Okay? It's important to note here, I'm not talking about the sexuality of children. Okay, I'm not talking about things that are in a gray area. And that's why we need to focus on the definition of child pornography. A visual depiction of children engaged in sexually explicit conduct. Using the federal definition, that includes actual or simulated sexual intercourse, described in a number of ways, bestiality, masturbation, sadistic or masochistic abuse, or lascivious exhibitions of the genitals or pubic area of any person. Okay, so we're not dealing with gray area expression items, I would submit, but we're dealing with things that meet the definition of child pornography. And I would suggest to ignore the reality of the social harms that these images cause simply because a juvenile created them, and to take prosecution off the table would be disingenuous to the duties that we owe those children. And furthermore, it ignores the social harms which form the very basis of our child pornography statutory scheme. Another question that someone might have, and I think a very valid one, is, well, how does injecting these people into the legal system, labeling a juvenile as a delinquent, how could that possibly help the situation? And that's where I would say a couple things are critical. First of all, the protocol is critical. That's why I have these factors, to separate that case that could benefit from civil protection, or maybe could benefit from no protection at all now that the problem has been identified, from the case that perhaps cannot, to distinguish between the case that has brought other juveniles into the production, or that has a more violent or different scheme to it than others, to help us separate and categorize these cases in a consistent and systemic way. Okay? But secondly, let's not forget about the juvenile system. Diversion is always a part of it. Currently in the juvenile system, we know that according to the 2006 National Report on Juvenile Offenders, 20% of all juvenile arrests are handled informally by the police. 50% of all cases referred to the court are handled informally. This is not new to suggest that we look at factors and decide which of this behavior are we going to bring into the adjudicatory system and which are we not. But I would submit that by applying these factors, we're able to assess the cases appropriately and decide what should go into the juvenile setting, either because the juvenile might be in need of a government intervention that is mandatory, i.e. they have to do what the judge says, or because the act itself is so harmful to society that society cannot justify looking the other way because a juvenile has produced it. I lastly think that it's worth mentioning deterrence a little bit. Deterrence is clearly not a founding principle of our juvenile justice system, and nor am I suggesting it is. But we want this behavior to stop. And if we can deter, through a general deterrence theory or a specific deterrence theory, juveniles from engaging in this behavior. And we know that juveniles refrain from engaging in behavior all the time because they know, gosh, I could get in trouble. Gosh, I could go to jail. Gosh, this could affect my opportunity to get into UVA. Who knows what it is, right? They can do that all the time. If it's clear that that is out there as a possible penalty, I would submit there's a deterrence value to my theory as well. Okay. My time is almost up. As I turn this over to my colleague, this is a highly complicated area. My solution is not perfect, and I don't pretend that it is. But I think that the removal from the table of criminal prosecution as a tool in society's arsenal to try to get a handle on this behavior is a mistake. It's a mistake, and it doesn't take into account the social harms that are created by the images, nor does it take into account the opportunity that the juvenile adjudication system affords us to help this juvenile or to stop the behavior. With that, I turn it over to my able colleagues to hear their thoughts.
Okay. I want to thank Professor Leary for those insightful remarks. Thank her for coming here, braving the traffic in Northern Virginia and the cops in Madison County to be with us today.
I thought you could help me with that.
I can't help myself with that. I also want to thank the Virginia Journal for Law and Social Policy for doing this. This is a very important issue, and in a way it's a highly empirical issue, and so I was tempted to do research, but I couldn't bring myself to put child pornography into Google. I have enough legal problems I didn't want to add to them. But seriously, I share Professor Leary's concern, obviously, about the proliferation of child pornography and her commitment to the goal of child protection. It's a very important problem. These children put themselves at great risk by putting themselves out there in full view of sexual offenders, predators, if you want to call them that, people who prey on children. It's very dangerous to put these kinds of images out there on the Internet. And Justin Berry's example, which was mentioned, and I'll mention it a little bit before, is just a great example. Justin Berry's story was told in the New York Times as a gripping article within the last year or so, I think, talking about his descent. He started by posing bare-chested in front of his webcam, and he ended up, you know, meeting sexual predators online, getting abused, turning into a child pornographer himself. He ran a for-profit pornographic website, and it was really just a shocking tale. That was my first exposure to this problem. And by the way, keep that in mind when you hear Stephen Colbert say the New York Times is destroying America. You know, it is, of course, destroying America, but sometimes it does good, and I think the Justin Berry story was good. Not that it was good to read, but we really need to know about the dangers that lie out there for children on the Internet. So the goal here of protecting children is very important. Still, here we have an important question of means, and I think I differ with Professor Leary, if I understand it correctly, as to the means. In my view, the question is pretty. The problem is complex, but the question we're addressing is fairly simple. Is arresting and prosecuting children for producing pornographic images of themselves, is that an appropriate response to this particular problem? And it seems to me that there is a role for the criminal law to play, but to me it's a much narrower role than I think Professor Leary has in mind. For me, the goal in this context is simply to rehabilitate these children, to get them to see the errors of their ways, to have an intervention that will lead them to stop putting these images out there and exposing themselves to danger. My goals are simply to reform children. I am a proud retributivist, but those sentiments are in check with this particular problem. I think these children need our help, and that the heavy hand of the criminal law isn't what they need. Before I offer some thoughts, or what purport to be thoughts, let me just react briefly to a couple of points. Professor Leary says that she's not in favor of mandatory prosecution, which is good to hear, and that she wants protocols in each jurisdiction so they can standardize their treatment of these issues. And that's all well and good, but of course decentralization, the lack of such protocols, is commonplace. That runs throughout criminal law. Prosecutors on an individual basis make these decisions almost invariably without prosecutorial guidelines. And so one question I would have is, why is this area any different? And I think this area is different. Why do we need standardization here when we have it in very few other places in criminal law? And I thought where you were going was that the matters aren't being handled appropriately in your view. In other words, maybe the prosecutors are being too mamby-pamby, too reluctant to file and prosecute criminal charges, and that's why I thought you wanted guidelines, was to force them to use the criminal law more than they have. I'm not sure that's your point, but to me, there's a little bit of a tension, I think, in your argument. To say on the one hand, I think it's quite right, as you say, and quite helpful to focus on the two different categories of children who could be harmed with self-induced pornography. You've got the children in the films and the children outside the films. I think that's a very important distinction, and you put a lot of weight on the children outside the films, obviously, because when you're dealing with self-produced child pornography, someone filming themselves doing things in front of their own webcam on their own initiative, you don't have, it's hard to see the kind of child harm to the child in the film that we typically see in child pornography. But if you really believe that children outside the film are really harmed, if self-produced child pornography is really just adding fuel to the fires of sexual predators and leading directly to the abuse and exploitation of children outside the films, then it seems to me you would want more prosecutions, because you want the deterrence, you want children to stop making these images of themselves because they lead to harm to kids outside the movie. So there's a little bit of a tension there. On the one hand, a rehabilitative approach would focus on the child, trying to straighten out the child behind the webcam. If you're concerned about the children outside the films, then I think you really do need more criminal prosecutions to get this stuff out. And for reasons I'll explain, I think we need to focus here in this problem of self-induced child pornography on the children within the films. But let me say, I think Professor Lee is exactly right that self-produced child pornography it does fall within the definition of criminal offenses. There's no exception. It doesn't say you have to be an adult in order to be guilty of the offense of child pornography. They don't say you have to use others in the production of the pornography. So a child who produces a pornographic image of himself or herself is guilty under these offenses, and therefore prosecutors can, under current law, no change is necessary, they can be prosecuted for these kinds of offenses today. There are laws on the books in every jurisdiction and the federal level authorizing those kind of prosecutions. What we're dealing with today is a question of prosecutorial discretion. How often, if ever, should prosecutors exercise their discretion to charge children for the crime of producing pornographic images of themselves? I think Professor Leary makes a very straightforward case for criminal prosecution. I mean, the legal theory, the logic is fairly sound, right? If in fact children outside the films are harmed by child pornography, and if it doesn't make a difference to the harm to the children outside the films, whether the pornography was self-produced or self-induced or not, then obviously you can prosecute for self-induced pornography no less than more conventional kinds of child pornography. I see that line of argument. It little reminds me of this problem about suicide. That sort of strikes me as sort of prosecuting attempted suicide as attempted murder, right? Because someone who's trying to murder laws typically are defined as killing a human being. It doesn't say someone else. It's killing a human being, and of course, someone who tries to commit suicide is trying to kill a human being, i.e., himself. If he succeeds in that endeavor, the harm is the same, a loss of a human life, right? And so by that logic, you might say we should prosecute attempted suicide as attempted murder. Today, at least, I think that would strike most of us as a rather bizarre way of responding to an attempted suicide. Why would that be bizarre? It'd be bizarre because a suicide attempt is a cry for help. This is a person who needs help. And the proper response of a compassionate society is to help people in those situations, not to add legal troubles and incarceration to their lists of woes. And I think exactly the same logic should apply when it comes to self-induced child pornography. It seems to me when we're dealing with the problem of self-induced child pornography, we're facing a different paradigm from what we see in the context of more typical child pornography. The paradigmatic case of child pornography, as you can imagine, is someone, usually an adult, using another child, someone else, a child, for purposes of sexual exploitation. In that situation, we've got two different harms to the victim, to the child within the films. We have two different victimizations, if you will. The first victimization occurs, of course, during the very production of the movie. As the Supreme Court noted, child pornography quite often is nothing more than molestation on film. Children are being molested, and it's being recorded or photographed. All right, so you've got the child being subjected to painful sexual abuse, forced to perform degrading acts, and acts that are psychologically scarring. These are activities to which no child should be subjected. That results in physical harm to the child in the films. It results in psychological harm and scarring as well. Quite often, these films are made by, the children are exploited by, not by strangers, but by people they know, by relatives, by neighbors. And that adds to the victimization that the children in the film suffer, because there's the abuse of trust that goes along with it. Not only do they have these horrible things done to them, but they're done to them by people in whom they place trust. That's the first victimization, the direct harm to the child within the film that flows necessarily from the making of paradigmatic child pornography. The second victimization is the memorialization of the images in a permanent record, the film, the video, whatever, that's posted on the internet. You know, with that stuff out there, it's out there in cyberspace, floating around, pops up. You become a contestant in the Miss America pageant, and it pops up, and it comes back to haunt you. These images are out there, and they're a perpetual reminder of the first victimization, of the sexual abuse the child suffered in the makings of the videos. And Professor Leary puts a lot of weight on the victimization prong, second victimization. But it seems to me it's the first victimization that's really critical. That's really why we are so harsh, and rightly so, when it comes to the production of child pornography, or to the you've got the molestation of children that's recorded. It's not so much the images; it's what's done to the children in producing those images. That's why I think we have such strict penalties for child pornography. That's why the Supreme Court has been so quick to exempt child pornography categorically from the reach of the Constitution. Let me skip forward and talk about whether punishment would help or hurt children here. It seems to me the heavy hand of the criminal law could raise more problems than it solves when it comes to the problems of self-induced pornography. At a minimum, you're ensnaring juveniles in the juvenile justice system. It's possible, depending on how state law is worded, that an overzealous prosecutor could elevate the matter, not even have it in juvenile court, prosecute the individual in question as an adult in criminal court, where you'd have substantial penalties. For example, in Virginia, Virginia law provides mandatory minimum penalties for the production of child pornography. The definition of child pornography production does not turn on the age of the producer. It doesn't say you have to use someone else. If you produce a sexually explicit image or video involving children, you're guilty. If the child is under age 15, the penalty ranges from a mandatory minimum of 5 years to a maximum of 30 years. So this is a pretty heavy weapon we're wielding here. Why such hard penalties in Virginia? Because the production of child pornography is classified as a sexually violent offense. So of course it's going to have a heavy penalty. You bring that case in adult court, no discretion, 5 years at least. These are harsh penalties, and they're more than appropriate and just for adults who exploit children to make these videos. I don't think any of us, and not even Professor Leary, wants to send children away for 5 years or more for taking pornographic images of themselves. Nevertheless, all this and more is possible once we treat juveniles in this context as appropriate objects of punishment. And again, I didn't do any research. I was terrified of attracting even more law enforcement attention. But it seems to me one question that I have is, who does this? You know, you can understand children in the traditional paradigm. They're abused. They're taken. They're assaulted. They're molested. Their participation is not voluntary. Who would voluntarily videotape, make sexually explicit images of themselves? It seems to me there are two cases. One case is, you know, just children, teenagers having sex. And I'll let you know in a secret. Teenagers have sex. Okay? And they all have cell phones. All right? And they know how to use them. All right? I think the culture, the culture in which this question arises is very important. We live in a very sexualized society, and society can say all it wants to that children shouldn't have sex under age 18. We know that they do. I saw some Kaiser Foundation statistics. It was safe to search for those. And they said the median age at which children, teenagers, have their first sexual experience, I think it was something like 16 for boys, 17 for girls, and that's a median. So that means there's a whole lot who get an earlier experience. So we live in a society where children are sexually active, just like some adults find some joy in videotaping themselves, which I don't understand. You know, Pam and Tommy Lee, for example. I don't understand the fetish with recording, especially not that, but I don't even understand people who videotape their own weddings. I mean, it just strikes me as bizarre. You know? But people do it. There's a healthy industry in that. So if teenagers are sexually active, and they record themselves, is that really something we want to get involved in the criminal justice system with the kind of heavy penalties that I've just mentioned? That's one possibility. That's one concern. I want to bracket that. My main concern is a second issue. I think kids who do this, who post these images of themselves, I think they're troubled children. They are children who need help. They may have mental problems. They may have been victims of sexual abuse themselves. They may have been abused in other ways at home. And so I think with that, and again, this is just intuition, I couldn't research it, but my intuition is that that's a large part of what we're dealing with when we're dealing with a problem of self-induced pornography. And Justin Berry from the New York Times story is just a great example of that. This kid was not fitting in at school, was having trouble. He was from a broken home. His mother wasn't supervising him well. And he turned to the internet for friends, and he posted that bare-chested video. Immediately he gets contacted by pedophiles asking him to do more, pose in his shorts. Then it started saying, well, if you do that, we'll send you, your webcam isn't that good, why don't we get you a better webcam so we perverts can enjoy you better. And then they did that, set up a PayPal account, we'll buy you whatever you want to, set up a little wish list, you do this, we'll pay you. And it went on and on and on. It got to a point where his father actually procured prostitutes for him to have sex with for part of their webcam business. So it really became a very substantial business. Justin Berry is a child who needs help, and I don't think the criminal law is a good way to give children like that help. Even if we keep it in juvenile court, the consequences could still be significant. Depending on the school disciplinary codes, you could see if children are charged in juvenile court, they could face school discipline of some kind, including school suspensions. Last thing we need to do is take these kids out of school and subject them to that. Minors convicted in juvenile court of pornography offenses can be required to register as sex offenders. Boy, that's a great way of helping kids. You're a sex offender, and now you got to register under Megan's laws. And now your neighbors know you're a sex offender, and now you can't live anywhere. And so it raises all these problems by getting this involved in the system. And so my approach is, where at all possible, we got to keep these cases involving self-induced pornography out of the criminal justice system. In fact, I can only see two instances where I think a prosecutor would want to file criminal charges against minors who create pornographic images of themselves. One is simply as a hammer to get the kid to do the right thing, to get the kid to cooperate with law enforcement. Minors who post pornographic images of themselves on the internet, it's like a feeding frenzy, right? It's like you have a pool of sharks, and you drop a little bit of meat in there, and the sharks go wild. That's the way it is with posting these images on the internet. There are lots of sexual predators out there who see children posting themselves, even posting images, sexually explicit images of themselves, and they go after them, they contact them. That's exactly what happened with Justin Berry. He was contacted by hundreds of men. He had extensive records, credit card records, identifying information. Actually, it graduated from just a purely internet relationship situation to he was actually had men sending him plane tickets, and he would fly as a juvenile to places like Las Vegas and to meet these guys and would get sexually molested. Luckily, in this instance, what's happened in Vegas didn't stay in Vegas. He turned his case over with the assistance of the New York Times to the FBI, which launched an incredible, brought a wave of indictments against these pedophiles. That's what we want, all right? We want juveniles to cooperate, who've done this, who've made this mistake, to cooperate with law enforcement in the apprehension of sexual offenders. Most times, I think they'll be more than willing to cooperate. Where they're unwilling, a criminal charge could be a nice inducement to get them to cooperate. Relatedly, we can use the criminal law as a lever to get these kids to stop making these images of themselves. Some children, some teenagers may feel like they have a right to do this. There's nothing wrong with it. It's their choice. Well, in that case, maybe we can use the criminal law. Again, and here I'm not, we can use the criminal law to get them to see the light, to say, you got to stop doing this. Take that pornographic material down. Get counseling. And we can get these materials out of circulation. The Pennsylvania cell phone porn case that Professor Leary mentioned is a case in point. The police used the criminal law exactly the way I'm suggesting. They went into the high school, said, everybody, you got a choice. The images were distributed by cell phones all over the school. And they said, bring in your cell phones and you won't be prosecuted. We want to make sure these images are destroyed. But if you don't bring in your images, all bets are off. And if we get you, we're prosecuting you for possession of child pornography. Note that in both of these situations that I'm advocating using the criminal law in, the use of the criminal law is A, a last resort, and B, it's therapeutic in purpose. The goal is to have an intervention that will get this child back on the right track. The goal is not to punish children. And so I don't think it's a problem that there aren't a lot of prosecutions being brought for this. I think it's actually a good thing. Obviously, just to avoid any misunderstanding, clearly if minors go too far, if they go beyond merely producing pornographic images of themselves, if they reach out and start using other children in the process, that's different. You're no longer in the self-induced model. To that extent, they're closer to the paradigm of your classic exploitative child pornography, and maybe they would deserve punishment in those situations. Obviously, even with respect, obviously with respect to self-induced pornography and other kinds of pornography, the adults who are involved in that, whether by producing it, enticing them, the minors to do it, by funding it or whatever, or possess them of resulting materials, any adult who's involved deserves punishment. I think also parents probably, there's a role for the criminal law to play in bringing negligent parents to bar for their conduct. Parents have a duty to supervise their children. If parents are allowing their kids to fly to Vegas to be molested, to set up internet porn operations in their houses, I don't think they're doing their jobs as parents. And maybe the criminal law can be used effectively to get parents to watch their children. Child Protective Services on the civil side can get involved here to help parents be better protectors of their children, and if necessary, to remove children from abusive or neglectful homes. So you see, I think there's a lot the government can do. There's even a healthy role for criminal law in this area. We need to get these images. We don't want these images to be created. We want to get them out of circulation. But I think when we're dealing with a child who produces these images of himself or herself, we need to take a therapeutic approach. The criminal law is too heavy-handed, even in juvenile court, to serve that purpose. And with that, I yield to my distinguished colleague.
Great. The hour is late, but I am going to go ahead and speak for at least 2 or 3 minutes. When we have panels of this kind, I think typically we are looking for an array of perspectives and sort of a balance the box, you know, some pro, some con. And so I guess one of the interesting issues here is with child pornography, no one's for it, right? It's the greatest evil. It is, we simply can't even talk about it. I admire Steve Smith for making you laugh a little bit. We can't joke about it. The only appropriate response is condemnation, right? Moral, legal condemnation. So we don't have any space in which we can discuss it. So I guess I want to make a couple of points. They're more sort of cultural, historical points. I think that the arguments about the appropriate role for criminal intervention have been very ably discussed and aired, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about history and then a little bit about the potential problems that we might encounter if Professor Leary's proposal is endorsed. The first thing, this category of what counts as child abuse, particularly child sexual abuse, this is a culturally constructed category, right? It's historically contingent. It's something that changes you know, with generation to generation. Am I saying it's not real? To the contrary, it's real. It's real for us in our generation, and the fact that our mores change and develop over time is a good thing. So in other words, it may be the case that we didn't see as abuse in the past things that today we believe are abusive, right? Well, that's a good thing, right? We're evolving, we're becoming more decent, we're treating each other better. But you certainly want to recognize that this is something that's historically contingent. And again, I'm mentioning this only because we want to be very careful. What is the it we're worried about? Now, the use of the phrase self-exploitation immediately brings to mind the old phrase self-abuse, which of course referred to masturbation. So the sort of the harm, the thing that most concerned parents and institutional leaders, a little more than 100 years ago, was masturbation. And, you know, all the parents were supposed to keep their children under surveillance, to arrange sleeping quarters and so forth. So nobody was masturbating. Okay? And so I think we don't tend to think that masturbation is evil anymore, at least not as evil as they thought. And again, I just want to be clear. The idea was that if you masturbated, you're going to become insane, potentially impotent, but almost certainly you're going to be confined to a lunatic asylum. And those were the beliefs at that time. We look back on that now and we go, how quaint, how strange. At least I do. It's taken me a while. It's taken me 50 years, right? Okay, but here I am. So again, I just want to say that we want to create a space, and we want to be very careful. So first point, it's historically contingent. It used to be masturbation. Today it's other stuff. And it's good that it's other stuff, okay? And that other stuff may be harmful, but we just want to think about it. So second point, we've got to be careful with our rhetoric. Now, Professor Leary was pretty careful with her rhetoric today. I heard a lot of slippage, though, between a description of the harms that are involved in child pornography generally and in this self-produced category, this very narrow category. And Professor Smith, I think, walked through or really clarified that you've got to keep your eye on what it is that Professor Leary is talking about. But many of you may not have read the paper, but the rhetoric in the paper is really inflammatory and, again, makes it very difficult to talk about. The paper mentions that this is a devastating plague. It's something that's invading our homes, our schools, our workforces with unstoppable force. It's a pestilence, severe harms. So all of this very suggestive rhetoric, again, I'm going, oh, my God, who am I to, you know, come in and say I'm for pestilence, I'm for plague. I mean, I'm not. I can't be, right? Nobody can be. In her speech today, she, again, was much more careful, but we were told it's an epidemic. It's exploding. It's toxic, haunting in perpetuity. So, again, I'm going, oh, my God. But, again, what is it? The rhetoric obscures much more than it clarifies. We can't talk about pestilence, guys. We've got to talk about what the underlying thing is. And we started to do that a little bit today. And I'm only going to do a little bit more because I'm old and Catholic. But so in any event, I think it's very important to focus precisely on what it is and not use words like pestilence or plague. Because if it's pestilence or plague, you need a great big shot of antibiotics or whatever it is that you do to get rid of the plague. You do not need the criminal law. Okay, you need something else. Okay, so then I started thinking about the underlying harms. And what's fascinating to me, again, is going back to the sort of masturbation example that I offered. What is the harm here? The thing we're talking about, and I'm like Stephen, I have tried to research porn before, and the one thing I learned is you do stay away from child porn. I mean, just no way, nobody wants to talk to you if you write about child porn, or at least that was my sense at the time. But again, we're talking about this very narrow category. It's sexual self-exploitation by minors. That's anybody who's under 18. And the age group that Professor Leary mentioned is that 15 to 17 years old, those are the biggest consumers of child porn. I'm not sure if that's the right number, but that sort of jumped out at me. And you can clarify that later because I'm sure I've got it wrong. I always do. Okay. So, but in any event, it's narrow. It's self-exploitation. Okay. So what's the harm? What is the harm? Is it minors having sex without the presence of an adult? They're not coercing each other, right? There's no force, there's no commerce involved, none. Now, those could be aggravating factors and so forth, but is it the kid's having sex? I mean, I got to be honest, you guys. Is it the kid masturbating or having sex? No, that's not the harm. It's the creation of the image and the dissemination of the image, okay? So that's what we need to focus on. What additional harms are created by the image? Again, it's perfectly fine for the... And so, again, this is where I may part company from both of my colleagues. Again, I have an 18-year-old. When Stephen said that kids are going to have sex, they're going to have sex. And you want them to, don't you? I mean, I'm not sure where, but sex is a good thing, right? I mean, have you all read Lawrence versus Texas? Justice Kennedy, you know, he's a man. You know, sex is no longer this harmful, terrible thing. Again, provided it's between consenting actors. And again, here, we're talking about 15 to 17-year-olds, guys. I'm not talking about toddlers or even 10-year-olds or 12-year-olds. I'm talking about that sort. So we want them to have sex. We want them. So you really need to, and we, so what's the harm? It's the creation of the image that becomes toxic. You know, and again, I'm just not sure I'm prepared to say that that's noxious or toxic. I mean, I don't take photographs of myself with my husband. Here, I've just gone and told you something. I feel compelled to say it, right? Because nobody, no good person would do these things, my colleagues are saying. I'm not as confident of that. I'm not as confident. Americans love to look at images of all kinds of stuff, and everybody seems to, at some point or other, tend to peek at porn. So again, we've got to be really clear. What's the harm you're worried about, and what is it that production adds above and beyond? Particularly above and beyond the harms that, as Stephen said, regularly produced child porn creates. I'm on board with that. I mean, there's just no doubt. We are all on board with that. Okay, the other thing that I wanted to mention very quickly, so again, are these troubled children? Nobody fits into school when they're 15 to 17. Everybody these days turns to the internet and to Facebook. That's where they live. That's where they talk. It's very hard for me to get used to. But again, the fact that a child is turning to the internet is not a sign that they're a troubled child, the fact that they're not fitting into school. So again, I have a lot of, I just have difficulty with some of these definitions. Again, the phrase re-victimize the victim. Where's the victim here? It's a 15 to 17-year-old who's taking a photograph of herself or himself and then displaying it. And again, I'm not so clear about what the core definition is, lascivious, you know, presentation of the genitals and so forth. Again, those have been very difficult definitions to apply, you guys. Very tough to apply. Okay. The other thing that I wanted to say very quickly is criminal law fixes are cheap. This is a serious social question, and I don't think that it is, I don't think that the larger harms are created by this specific group. It's created by a culture that objectifies everybody, it certainly objectifies children. And children are getting very mixed signals. On the one hand, the parents are going, oh my God, don't put that photograph of yourself on the Facebook. On the other hand, they're looking at mainstream magazines in which they are being sold, I mean, again, my child's a girl, items of lingerie. I mean, you know, it's, so it's very, they're getting very mixed signals about what, how they're supposed to present themselves. This is not something, this is not an issue, a phenomenon that's created by the category, the professor. It's much, much bigger. It's a much more large societal phenomenon. There's no way you're going to fix it with criminal law. And again, criminal law fixes are cheap. If you are truly concerned about helping troubled children, you're going to get your legislators to pass a criminal law? You bet they'll do it. They'll do it just like that. Why? Because they don't have to pay for it. They don't have to spend a penny taking care of children who are, in fact, troubled, who, you know, have needs, have abuse, forms of abuse, sexual or otherwise. They'll just go ahead and put it on the books and leave it to the prosecutors, which leads me to my last point. In studying the question of feminist arguments for regulating adult pornography, there are some good arguments there that pornographic images objectify women, that is, you know, adult porn I'm talking about now. And perhaps we should extend our definition of obscenity so that it covers sort of just hardcore porn. Okay, whatever that means. The line is blurry. The problem that I've discovered is that it's hard to trust prosecutors. I mean, assuming that you wanted to do this, and I'm not saying that any of you do, it's really hard to trust prosecutors, to trust communities. Because typically what happens when these laws are enacted, whose porn is targeted? I'm an old Catholic lady, so I don't have any porn, so I can just say not mine. It's gay porn. So the porn that looks the most offensive, the porn that is the most problematic, is gay porn. So that tends to get targeted. So again, alternative sexualities. And that's another concern that I have here. Again, remember, we're living in a post-Lawrence world. The idea that these are troubled kids having sex, that's going to be determined by prosecutors. And I fear, again, that the targets would be gay youth. And that's just not a risk that I'm willing to run. So anyway, for the sake of being contentious at 6 o'clock at night, there you have it.